push this button. Yeah, that's good. Okay, hello, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's November 26th, and your test is in 2 weeks. I believe it's on the 15th at 1 to 3 in this room. All right, but always double-check the schedule, and I'll bring the schedule in next time. So I believe that's true. All right, so we're talking cardiovascular system, and we're going to finish up chapter 13 today. And we skipped over a bunch of heart anatomy, but that you should know already. Like, how many valves does a heart have?
Four.
How many chambers does a heart have?
Four.
Yeah, you should just know all that kind of stuff. And the blood vessels coming off the base of the heart, and the pulmonary circulation, and the systemic circulation. All right, and we're going to start talking about some of the dynamics of the heart today. And you learned what the function of a valve is. What the heck is the function of a valve? In the cardiovascular system, or even the lymphatic system, where do we find valves? We find valves in the veins. Somebody said veins. I like that. There are valves in veins. They perform the same function as valves in the heart, and valves in the lymphatic vessels as well. So valves allow blood to flow only in one direction. We call that the anterograde direction, and it prevents the backward flow of blood. The backward flow of blood is what we call retrograde. So valves prevent retrograde flow of blood in the heart, in veins, and in lymphatic vessels. Okay, so that's the function of a valve. So since we're looking at blood flow, what is moving blood around through your circulatory system? What parameter moves blood around? How does blood move? It goes from one place to another. And how does it know to go from one place to another place? What's causing it to flow from one place to another? Okay, the heart. Yeah, it's the job of the heart to make sure that it flows. But what is the heart giving to blood so that, a force. And that force we call pressure. Okay, so it's just pressure. So a fluid will flow through a concentration gradient. No, not concentration gradient, pressure gradient. All right, so just like for diffusion, what's the force, the motivating force for diffusion? That's when I just misspoke a second ago. That's a concentration gradient, so a substance will move down a concentration gradient. What does that mean? From high concentration to low, or from low to high? Passively, without energy, without the expenditure of ATP. Always from high to low, right? Substances will move down their concentration gradient from high to low without requirement of ATP. Well, the same thing is true for the movement of a fluid. When a fluid moves, it's going to move down a pressure gradient, and it will always move from high pressure to low pressure. That's how a fluid is always going to move. And let's see if we know what a fluid is. What is a fluid? Is what? Okay, a fluid is, well, give me an example of a fluid. Water is a fluid. So a fluid is something that can flow. All right, what about the air in this room? Can that flow from one place to another? Yeah. So a gas is a fluid as well. So liquids and gases are both fluids, and they will always move from an area of high pressure to an area of low pressure. And it's the job of the heart to develop high pressure so that blood is ejected from the heart into an artery, and that blood is going to flow from an artery into a vessel that has the lowest pressure. And what vessel has the lowest pressure in your body? Well, you got what? Arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, or veins? Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's going to be a vein, and the vein that has the absolute lowest pressure is the vena cava. So blood is always drawn to the vena cava, and probably actually the lowest part, the lowest pressure in the body is in the right atrium, so that blood even flows from the vena cava into the right atrium. So fluids always flow from high pressure to low. All right, but in the heart, there might be a circumstance where there's high pressure in a ventricle and low pressure in an atrium, and we don't want blood to flow retrograde from the ventricle into an atrium. We want blood to flow from a ventricle where? Into trace it into an artery, like the aorta or pulmonary trunk, for instance. So what is preventing the retrograde flow of blood from a ventricle back into an atrium? A valve, like an atrioventricular valve. On the right side of the heart, that is the... What valve is that on the right side of the heart? What's the right atrioventricular valve? You haven't burned that picture of a heart in your mind just yet. That's the tricuspid valve, and on the left side, that's the bicuspid or mitral valve. All right, so blood will flow, like I said, always from high pressure to low. And blood flows from this right atrium into the right ventricle, for instance, when this right atrium contracts, pressurizes blood, the tricuspid valve is open, and it pumps blood into the right ventricle. And then as the right ventricle starts to contract, blood is going to try to go back up into the right atrium, but because of the tricuspid valve, the arrangement right here, see, blood comes back up under here, and it forces this leaflet into this leaflet over here, which is moving in this direction, and the valve closes. All right, so this atrioventricular valve closes when the ventricles contract, right? Because then there's going to be high pressure in the ventricle and low pressure in the atrium right here. All right, so that's what we want to start talking about. So don't forget, the heart is a reciprocating pump. That means that there are times when it contracts and then there are times when it relaxes. Both of these phases of the cardiac cycle are important. Right, because without contraction, the heart won't pump blood. But without relaxation, blood can't get in the heart for it to pump when it does contract. So both phases are very important. And they are called systole and diastole. Right, the first chambers to contract are the atria. And then about a quarter of a second later, about 100 or 200 milliseconds later, the ventricles contract. Both ventricles contract together. So you can see that the atria load some blood into the ventricles when they're still relaxed, when the ventricles are relaxed, so that when the ventricles do contract, they're filled with blood. Okay, so here are some parameters that we want to consider. The end diastolic volume. What the heck is the end diastolic volume? And we're mostly interested in ventricles here. We're not going to look at much in the way of function of the atria because they don't do a really big job. Unless they're behaving very poorly, we're not so concerned with them clinically. We're really concerned with the function of the ventricles. So what kind of volume is the end diastolic volume of a ventricle? Where are we going to look? Where in the cardiac cycle? What's diastole? That is relaxation. And what happens during relaxation? Is the heart pumping blood or is it filling? It's filling with blood. That's right. So, and as the heart is filling, what happens to the volume of the ventricle? Does it get smaller or bigger? Yeah, it gets bigger. As it's filling, it gets bigger and bigger. And right at the end of diastole, that's the biggest volume that the heart has, right before it starts to contract. All right, the heart won't expand anymore because it's filled with blood, and blood won't be able to get into the heart when the ventricles start to contract. So the end diastolic volume is the volume of blood in the ventricles at the end of diastole. And just make a little note, that's the largest volume, okay? Because the heart has filled with blood at the end of relaxation or the end of diastole. The next term is stroke volume. This is the amount of blood that is ejected from the ventricles during systole. So the ventricles might have a volume of, say, 20 milliliters at end diastole, and when it contracts, it's going to squirt out a certain amount of blood, maybe 10 milliliters. These are sort of absurd numbers, but to give you an idea, maybe 10 milliliters. So the stroke volume then would be 10 milliliters. All right, but if the stroke volume is 10 milliliters, how much blood is left in the heart? End diastolic volume, we said, was 20. And if the stroke volume is 10, what's the end systolic volume then? It's going to be 20 minus 10 or 10 milliliters. So the heart, when it contracts, it can't pump out all the blood. It just does the best job that it can. All right? There's always some volume, amount of blood left in the ventricles after contraction. So we call that end systolic volume. So we can actually calculate the stroke volume of the heart by looking at the end diastolic volume and the end systolic volume. So for instance, stroke volume, I'm going to just put SV right here. What is SV equal to? It's the large volume minus the small one, right, which is what? End diastolic volume minus end systolic volume. That's the stroke volume. That's the amount of blood that the heart pumps out for every beat, every time the heart contracts. So that's probably an important relationship to become aware of, and we should probably type that on that slide right there. Okay, and so don't forget, when the heart contracts during systole, that imparts pressure to the blood, and it flows out. Okay, so as the ventricles contract, pressures rise in the ventricles. Blood tries to go back up into the atria, because the atria now are starting to relax. But what prevents that from happening? The AV valves, right? They close as the ventricles start to contract. All right, so this period of time is what we call isovolumetric contraction. All right, as the ventricles start to contract, the pressure increases, right, and the heart squeezes more strongly and more strongly on the blood inside the ventricle. But because this AV valve closes, blood can't go back up into the atria, and at this time, the other valves are closed as well. The valves in the great arteries off the base of the heart, namely the aorta and pulmonary trunk. All right, so let me go to next slide. So here is a graph of a number of different things during versus time. So time is this axis over here. We're going to look at pressure, and we're going to look at volume, and then here are some heart sounds even. Do I see an ECG on here? I don't see an ECG, but your lab book has a really nice chart that shows many different pressure curves. All right, so this, how about blue line? Is that blue? Blue to you? All right, so this is the pressure in the left ventricle. All right, so we see that during diastole, when the ventricle is relaxed, what's the pressure? It's basically zero, right? And because it's zero, guess which way blood is going? Is it flowing into the ventricle or out? It's flowing in because it has very low pressure. Right? So blood is flowing into the ventricles during diastole. And then we see a little bump of pressure right here. Guess what that's due to? All of a sudden, the pressure inside the ventricles increase a little bit transiently, and that's due to contraction of the atria. When they contract, they force a little blood in the ventricles, and that causes that little transient rise in pressure. Okay, and after the atria contract, then the ventricles start to contract. And what do we see? What happens to pressure? It shoots up as the ventricles contract. Okay, so right at about this point in time, right here, the pressure in the ventricle becomes greater than the pressure in the atria. So the pressure in the atria kind of going to follow along this line right here. Pressure in the atria increase a little bit, and then they start to relax. The ventricles start to contract, and these two lines are going to cross over each other right here. So right where I have the cursor now is where we have high pressure in the ventricle and low pressure in the atria. So which way is blood going to want to go? From the atria to a ventricle or ventricle back into the atria? From the ventricle back into the atria, but it can't. Because why? Because there's an AV valve there, and it closes right at about this point right here. And then the heart contracts, squeezes the blood, until we get to this point right here. That's close. Actually, right about here, for instance. All right, now right at about this region, well, can anybody tell me what the normal blood pressure is in somebody? Arterial blood pressure. What's a good ballpark? Good, healthy blood pressure. So let's just work with these normal numbers. 120 over 80. Okay, so 120 is what pressure? That's the systolic pressure, and 80 is what we call the diastolic pressure. All right, so that is the lowest pressure in the aorta. So the ventricles are going to pump blood into the aorta, and right at this point right here This is when the pressure in the left ventricle is greater than the pressure in the aorta, right? Because at diastole, the pressure in the aorta is going to be about 80 millimeters of mercury. But now we can see what the ventricles are contracting, generating even more pressure than what's in the aorta. Blood is going to flow from high pressure to low. So what's going to happen to the blood in the ventricles here? Now that it's higher pressure than the aorta, it's going to move from the ventricle into the aorta. There's a valve there. What's the valve between the left ventricle and the aorta? That's the aortic semilunar valve. That's the aortic semilunar valve. So it opens, right around 80 millimeters of mercury, and the ventricles that eject that blood into the aorta, boosting it up to the systolic pressure. Right then, right about at this time, the heart actually starts to relax a little bit, or it is, as it's ejecting blood from the ventricles, the pressure decreases. All right, so now the pressure inside the aorta becomes greater than inside the ventricle. So notice the ventricular pressure is starting to decrease, but the pressure in the aorta is greater than 100 millimeters of mercury. So blood is going to want to go from the aorta back into the ventricle, left ventricle. But what's going to happen at this location here? This is when the semilunar valve is going to close, because the pressure is going to try to flow backwards into the left ventricle. Okay, so when that happens, the semilunar valve closes. All right, then the ventricles relax and they start to fill again during diastole. Okay, so what we don't have here is aortic pressure, but in your book or in your lab book, you have a nice aortic pressure curve. And so wherever these lines cross over, there are valves that are going to close. All right, so don't forget which way fluid is going to move. So which way will fluid have a tendency to move again? What's the motive force again? A pressure, right? A pressure difference. It's always going to move from high pressure to low pressure. Okay, so this period of time, right when the AV valve closes, compared to this time right here when the semilunar valve opens up, the size of the ventricle is not changing. So this, in between these dotted lines, this is what we call the period of isovolumetric contraction. Because both valves are closed, the AV valve is closed here, the semilunar valve is closed until we get to this point right here, so the heart is contracting, but the volume isn't changing. So that's isovolumetric, meaning that the volume isn't changing. But the heart is still contracting, just the volume is not changing. All right, and then from this time right here, when the semilunar valve closes again, the AV valve, right, is still closed because there's still pressure in the ventricles. This is what we call isovolumetric relaxation. So the blood can't go anywhere if all the valves are closed. Okay, so the curve right here of volume versus time, we can see that the volume, let's start right here. Right, during diastole, the ventricle starts to fill with blood because it's relaxing. When the atria contract, the ventricles expand a little bit more, right? And then as the ventricles contract from here to here, the valves are closed, so the size of the ventricles can't change, but the pressure still increases, right? As soon as the semilunar valve opens up, then blood is ejected from the heart. So this is the systolic pressure in the ventricle. This is the diastolic pressure in the ventricle. And number one right here signifies a volume, the volume of the heart. And we could read it up over here. It's about 120 mLs. All right, but what of the terms that we've defined so far, what volume is this? Is this at the end of systole or the end of diastole? That's the end diastolic volume. And remember, the end diastolic volume is the big number. Right, that's the big one. That's the largest size of that particular chamber. And then as the heart starts to eject blood, down over here, number three, all right, what volume is that? That's the end of systole. This is the end systolic volume. And if we subtract these two, we get number two right here, which is the stroke volume of the heart. All right, so stroke volume of the heart is going to be very important for understanding how we regulate blood pressure and perfusion in tissues. Right, so you got to be kind of familiar with stroke volume. Okay, another important parameter is sometimes we like to look at the stroke volume of the heart and compare it to the total volume of the heart. Remember, we came up with a percentage number for looking at the percentage of red blood cells in whole blood. What did we call that? That's an important clinical marker for something. What is that called? Hematocrit. That's a percent volume of red blood cells in whole blood. Well, we can look at the percentage of stroke volume compared to the whole volume of the heart. Right? So if the heart was ejecting everything, so from about 120 mLs all the way down to zero, okay, we would compare to what the whole volume of the heart was. That would equal one, and that would mean a tremendously healthy heart, all right? And nobody's heart really works that well. But if the heart only pumps out only about half the blood in it, then the ejection fraction is going to be 50%, all right? And so that's a measure that the heart is kind of sick, kind of pathological. It's not pumping out a lot of blood compared to the whole volume of the heart. And ejection fraction is real important for determining the state of the heart. Maybe the heart has a problem due to a leaky valve or something like that. And ejection fraction is probably the most important indicator of the state of the health of the heart and what the benefit of a particular procedure will be, like when somebody has a valve repair. Because there's a certain point when the heart gets so sick, even if we repair things that are wrong with it, it can't ever get back to normal again. It's still going to be very deficient. Okay, so on this graph right here, these heart sounds represent closing of valves, right? And that's just due to pressure changes either between the atrium and the ventricle or between a ventricle and an artery, like the aorta. The first sound right here happens at the beginning of systole. So at the beginning of systole, what valve closes? During systole. So when systole, the ventricles contract, they pressurize, and okay, you got a couple of choices. You got AV valves or the semilunar valves. Well, during systole, the ventricles are going to try to pump blood back up into the atria, but they can't because the AV valves close. So the first heart sound is due to closure of the AV valves. And then, so the ventricles pump blood into the aorta. And then as the ventricles relax, blood in the aorta tries to flow backward into the ventricle, but it can't because then the semilunar valves close. So that produces the second heart sound. So you got a lup and a dup right here. So the first sound is closure of the AV valves. The second is closure of the semilunar valves. And you could memorize that, but it's probably easier just to kind of figure out why that happens because of pressure changes across those valves. And valves usually don't make a noise when they open up. They make a noise when they close. Because when they close, it's a relatively violent reaction. The heart contracts with a lot of vigor, and the valves really just slam closed, and they make quite a lot of noise. I can't quite hear anybody's valves in here, but almost. Okay. Easy to hear with a stethoscope, for instance. Okay. All right, so that's how you should look at that curve. Sometimes we do have abnormal heart sounds, and they're produced by abnormal patterns of blood flow in the heart. And this can be due to a couple different reasons. Many are caused by defective heart valves. They can be congenital in origin. Sometimes they can be, what do we call something that's not congenital? Something that occurs over your lifespan for whatever reason. Congenital is you're born with that condition, but if it happens over your lifetime, it gradually appears, or maybe it appears all of a sudden, we say developmental. So congenital as opposed to developmental. And For instance, one developmental heart condition could be rheumatic fever due to an infection, right? And your body produces antibodies to fight that infection, but those antibodies can also bind to different parts of the heart and damage the heart, and in particular, heart valves. Okay, so the streptococcus bacteria sometimes, or the antibodies to the streptococcus bacteria cross-reacts with heart tissue. All right, there are a lot of chemotherapy agents that are used for treatment of cancer are also cardiotoxic and might damage valves. That's just one of the unfortunate side effects of chemotherapy. And even MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus can even infect the heart valves. Okay, so there certainly can be things that damage heart valves as you live your life. And so what happens to a heart valve then? Well, a couple things can happen. Maybe the structure of the valve has been damaged to where they don't close properly anymore. So when, let's go back to looking at a picture of the heart. So when the pressures inside the ventricles go above the pressure in the atria right here, if this valve doesn't close properly, then blood is going to squirt back up into the right atrium. And when it squirts, okay, it's going to make a squeaking sound, just like when you blow up a balloon and kind of let the air kind of escape out, kind of, it'll make a squeaking sound, and it will sound like that. So that's what we call a heart murmur. And that's due to this valve that's no longer working properly, so we call that an incompetent valve or an insufficient valve. And we have to find out maybe why that happened, but it has to be repaired or replaced when that happens, because otherwise that's eventually going to kill the ventricle. All right, so if the job of the ventricle is to pump blood into the artery, but it's not going into the artery, it's actually pumping backwards, then that's going to kill the ventricle eventually. And I suppose you could kind of think of, if you were to run up these stairs, that would be quite a bit of effort, right? You'd be winded, right? But now, think of stairs, but think of a sand dune, okay? So every time you take a step up a sand dune, what happens? You slide backwards. So how hard is it to run up a sand dune compared to just a flight of stairs? Your impression of running up these stairs is probably, oh, it's arduous, right? But running up a sand dune is what? Even 10 times harder, right? So that's what your heart has to do if it has a leaky valve. It has to work like 10 times harder, and it just destroys itself when that happens, okay? Okay, so that's due to an incompetent valve right here. Something else that can happen to a valve is that maybe not only doesn't it close properly, but maybe it doesn't open all the way either. Maybe it becomes constricted, and when it doesn't open all the way, that doesn't help you out because then blood can't flow from the atrium into a ventricle. And when blood flows in, okay, it might also make some sounds. So that's what we call a stenotic valve. And in those circumstances, well, depending on the circumstances, that valve should be replaced as well, repaired or replaced if at all possible. Okay, so mitral stenosis. For instance, that's when the mitral valve becomes thickened and calcified. That impairs blood flow from the atrium into the left ventricle. Accumulation of blood in the left ventricle can cause pulmonary hypertension. Well, let's go back to this slide right here. All right, so if blood isn't flowing from the left atrium into the left ventricle, that's going to cause a backup of pressure into the pulmonary circulation. All right, we call that pulmonary hypertension, and that's going to destroy the capillaries in the lungs, which are, of course, very important for your normal everyday health. And that's really kind of unfortunate because it's difficult to measure pulmonary pressure. When you get your blood pressure taken, right, you're always going to measure systemic pressure because you only have access to systemic arteries. You don't have access to any of the pulmonary arteries that are deep inside your thoracic cavity. Okay, so hardly anybody ever knows what their pulmonary pressure is. All right, or you can have incompetent valves because they don't close properly. And that could be due to valves, could be due to damage to the chorded tendineae, or even papillary muscles themselves. Okay, other abnormalities in the heart. These usually are not developmental, but some can persist for a long period of time. Usually these are congenital, where you might have a foramen in the interventricular septum or even the interatrial septum. And in utero, you have a natural interatrial foramen. What's the name of that foramen between the atria, which is, of course, you have to have as a fetus? What is that called? That's the foramen ovale, right? Because in utero, you're not using your lungs. You're just using the placenta. So blood is shunted from the lungs directly, taken from the right atrium and placed in the left atrium over here via the foramen ovale. Okay, but as soon as you're born, that hole should close over, or very shortly after you're born, it should close over. But sometimes it remains open. We call that a patent foramen ovale, or a PFO. And that will eventually destroy the heart as well, though I've known some people to get probably well into their 50s before they had any kind of clinical symptoms. So it can persist for a long period of time, but it has to be surgically repaired. And probably recently, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, there's a group at Stanford that developed a technique to where they can do that just with angio methods. So they can just thread different tubes up from a vein to reach the heart. It doesn't have to be open heart surgery anymore, which is pretty amazing. It used to be open heart surgery to get at that PFO to close it. Okay. More damaging would be interventricular septal defect. Okay, and so you can see blood squirting from the left ventricle into the right ventricle over here. And again, that's going to kill the heart because the heart's working way too hard to pump blood into the aorta. And why do you see blood squirting into the right ventricle over here? How come you don't see blood squirting from the right ventricle into the left ventricle? Yeah, because fluid always flows from high pressure to low. And the left ventricle has to pump blood through the whole systemic circulation. That pressure is a lot higher than the pulmonary circulation. And indeed, if you look at a good diagram of a heart, you'd always see that the left ventricle, the myocardium, is always a lot thicker than the right ventricle. We don't see it on this diagram. And that's because the left ventricle has to develop much higher pressure to pump blood through the systemic circulation. So when the ventricles contract, blood will flow from the left to the right ventricle because that's the pressure gradient. And when it squirts through here, guess what you hear? You hear a murmur. You hear a heart sound that doesn't belong. Okay, it's going to be a swishing or squeaking sound depending on the nature of that septal defect. Okay, I don't know of anybody who knows how to repair that without doing open heart surgery. All right, so those are heart defects. Electrical activity of the heart. All right, here's some interesting physiology. Remember, what kind of cells make up the myocardium? What are they specialized to do? What are the four kinds of tissues that make up your body? You got what? Starting with epithelium. What's another kind of tissue? Connective tissue. What's another kind? Blood is a kind of connective. Blood is kind of a connective tissue, all right? So you got epithelium, connective, what else? You got muscle, somebody said muscle. Nervous tissue. Those are the four kinds of tissue. Yeah, I just didn't quite hear you. So that's the four kinds of tissue. So what's the myocardium, what kind of tissue is the myocardium made up of? It's muscle. What's muscle specialized to do? Yeah, to shorten or contract, but this is a special kind of muscle tissue. Of all the subtypes of muscle tissues, what kind makes up the heart? Okay, well, let's say what the kinds of muscle are. How many kinds are there? There's three. Yeah, there's skeletal muscle. There's cardiac muscle. And smooth muscle. Okay, which two are involuntary? Smooth and cardiac. And which is the only thing that you have control of in your body, that is skeletal muscle. All right, so the heart is made up of cardiac muscle, but I wanted you to see where it fit in with everything. But what are some of the characteristics? What are some of the the histological features of cardiac muscle as opposed to skeletal muscle. So I tell you what, let's start with skeletal first. What does skeletal muscle look like? It's striated, yeah, which means it has, what are the contractile units? Sarcomeres. It's made up of sarcomeres, this is true. But what's some of the larger aspects of skeletal muscle? What does it look like underneath a microscope besides striated? If you were to look at an individual cell, I think I saw you say fiber, okay? A fiber means what? It's long and narrow. And so it's just a really long, linear cell, right, that has many nuclei in it. It's loaded with those sarcomeres. What about cardiac muscle? They're short, okay? They're short and branched. So they're not like a fiber at all. They're branched. I don't know if I have a picture. I don't have a picture of one. Okay, which means I got to draw. So here is what kind of muscle looks like this. Skeletal. And what kind of muscle looks like this? Yeah, this is cardiac because it's branched. It's striated, so there's sarcomeres in there. All right, and then here is the next myocardial cell here, and it's branched as well, for instance, like that. All right. How do nerves control this skeletal muscle right here? Neuromuscular junction. Okay, and what kind of synapse is this? Remember, there are two different kinds of synapses? Okay. This is a chemical synapse because the axon has to release a neurotransmitter that diffuses across the synaptic cleft, which then opens up sodium channels in the muscle membrane, depolarizing it or exciting it to contract. So this is a chemical synapse. Okay, and then this muscle fiber is going to contract. But cardiac muscle is quite a bit different. It does not need innervation to contract. It will contract all by itself. So just like Raiders of the Lost Ark, if we were to take a heart out of some mammal, even an amphibian or reptile, and put it on the table, guess what it's going to do? It's going to keep contracting until it runs out of energy. It might slow down, for instance, as it gets cold, but it's going to keep beating. Okay? And the whole heart beats as a unit. Your skeletal muscles don't do that, and that's a really good thing, right? You don't want to contract the biceps and have your whole body contract. Right, so that would be kind of senseless. But your whole heart contracts together because the synapses, okay, are located between the cells. So here is a junction between these cells. What did we call this junction? That's an intercalated disc. Yeah, intercalated disc. And one of the components that make an intercalated disc are these gap junctions. And gap junctions allow sodium ions to move from one cell to the next. And when that sodium ion moves from this cell to this one over here, what happens to the cell here? It depolarizes, which is the signal for contraction. And when this cell depolarizes, what about the next one? It depolarizes as well. So this electrical signal can go from one cell to another. You don't find that in skeletal muscle. Okay. And because it's branched, not only does this fiber excite this one here, but it can excite cells that lie above it or below it because of the branching pattern. That's why there has to be branching patterns in cardiac muscle. Because you don't want just one layer of the myocardium to contract. You want what? The whole wall thickness to contract when it becomes excited due to those gap junctions in the myocardial cell. Okay, so the entire muscle that forms the chamber is called the myocardium. It acts as a functional syncytium. That just means that when one cell depolarizes, all the cells in that chamber depolarize as well because of the gap junctions. That's a functional syncytium. So action potentials originating in any cell are transmitted to all others. The chambers, at least the atria, are separated electrically from the ventricles. And they're separated because they contain the fibrous skeleton of the heart. There's a fibrous skeleton, there's a fibrous layer of connective tissue between the atria and the ventricles. And that tissue doesn't conduct action potentials. Okay, so here is the fibrous skeleton right here. Right? Usually, the atria contract first before the ventricles, because there's a pacemaker that can be found in the right atrium, near the entrance of the superior vena cava, or the orifice of the superior vena cava in the right atrium. So these are special, we're looking at special conduction, electrical conduction system of the heart. These are specialized muscle cells. These are not neurons, but they're specialized muscle cells. But remember, muscle cells have voltage-gated sodium channels, just like axons do. So they act like nerves to a large extent as well. And the sinoatrial node spontaneously depolarizes. Right, so we call that the sinoatrial node, and that depolarization is what we call a pacemaker potential. So if we were to look at the membrane voltage on these cells right here, it would look something like this. Right, so this is a plot of voltage versus time. So probably you could flash back to earlier in the class what an action potential looked like. Right, with an action potential, it was without stimulation, it was what, just rock steady. What did we call the baseline measurement of an action of the cell voltage before an action potential? That's what we called RMP. What's RMP? Resting membrane potential. Okay. And then if there was a stimulus, what would happen to RMP? It would move up to zero. We call that depolarization, right? And if it reached threshold, then an action potential would ensue. Okay. Well, if we were to look at the cells of the sinoatrial node, I don't see anything that really looks like a resting membrane potential. There's nothing that's constant, that's steady. All right, I see kind of the highest voltage right here at about minus 60 millivolts, but as soon as the membrane potential reaches about minus 60 millivolts, there are sodium channels that open up. So there are voltage-gated sodium channels that open up. We call that an HCN channel. And when that HCN channel opens up, look what happens. It causes depolarization of that cell, and when it reaches threshold, then other voltage-gated calcium channels open. Calcium is high outside the cell. Calcium rushes in, causing a massive depolarization. Okay, and then, of course, the potassium channels open up. That repolarizes the cell. All right, and then when it comes back down to about minus 60 again, those HCN channels open up and the cells just spontaneously start to depolarize without stimulation from a nerve. And this just happens over and over and over again, producing a heartbeat. So this depolarization in the cells of the sinoatrial node then can flow from one cell to another within the atria, because the atria are a functional syncytium as well, and the atria contract. Right, so don't forget, this electrical activity right here is not exactly the same as tension that's developed when a muscle contracts. The electrical activity is just the signal for contraction. Okay, it's not the actual physical contraction of the heart. Okay, so this is what we call a pacemaker potential right here due to these HCN channels, which are sodium channels that open up, that reach threshold. All right, so all tissues in the heart are spontaneously active, but the rate of depolarization, or the slope of this pacemaker potential right here, and all other tissues of the heart is not as steep. They just take longer to reach threshold. All right, but since the sinoatrial node reaches threshold first, and these electrical signals can flow from one cell to the other, right, it's the pacemaker that controls the sinoatrial node that controls the rate of heart contraction. All right, so all other tissues in the heart are slower than the SA node. They can be stimulated to produce action potentials by the SA node before they spontaneously depolarize to threshold. All right, if action potentials from the SA node are prevented from reaching the heart, right, then the other parts of the heart will develop their own pacemaker potentials and will control the heart rate. All right, so let's look at the rest of the conduction system. All right, so the SA node fibers depolarize first because they have the fastest rate. Action potentials will flow over both atria, and then they're going to depolarize the atrioventricular node right here. But the atrial ventricular node transmits electrical signals very slowly, and it delays the entry of the signal into the ventricles, number one. Number two, this is the only pathway for electrical signals to enter the ventricles, because everywhere else between the atria and ventricles is the fibrous skeleton, and electrical signals can't conduct through that region. So this is a delay for entry of the electrical signal, so the atria contract first. Then depolarization excites the atrioventricular bundle. Sometimes we call that the bundle of His. And these depolarize very rapidly. And then that transmits signals into the bundle branches through the interventricular septum down to the apex of the heart, where they stimulate Purkinje fibers, which then depolarize the myocardial cells at the apex of the myocardium, which then causes the myocardial tissue of the ventricles to contract. So first the atria contract, pumping blood into the ventricles. The electrical signal catches up, goes all the way down to the apex, and it causes the apical regions of the ventricle to contract first, pumping blood, back up to the base and out the arteries at the base of the heart. All right, so this is the pathway of conduction through the heart, starting with the SA node, AV node, bundle of His, down the bundle branches, and then finally into Purkinje fibers that spread that wave of depolarization all over the heart. Now, and don't forget, these are not nerve fibers. These are specialized muscle cells that conduct action potentials. All right, so if someone has a heart attack, maybe in this region of the heart, because a blood vessel that supplies this region of the heart got blocked, then these conduction cells, right, what happens to these myocardial cells that are conducting these impulses from the atrium into the ventricle? What happens to them if we cut off blood supply to them? What do these cells need? They need, take a deep breath, don't fall asleep, they need oxygen, right? They need oxygen to stay alive. And if we cut off blood supply, they don't have oxygen, they're going to die. This part of the heart is going to necrose. And when it dies, it forms a scar, and electrical signals can't move from the atria down into the ventricles. So the SA node, in that case, is going to control the rhythm of the atria, and then another pacemaker is going to develop in the ventricles, because all myocardial cells have a tendency to depolarize at their own rate due to pacemaker potentials. So the heart will have, for instance, like two pacemakers, one in the atria and one in the ventricles. And how is the heart going to function then? The atria will beat at one rhythm, and the ventricles are going to beat at a slower rhythm as a result of that, and it's not going to be coordinated. Okay, so we can see that in an ECG very easily. And usually that's not too clinically significant, because as you saw in that one pressure curve, the amount of pressure that the atria develop is relatively small compared to the whole pressure that the ventricles develop. Our hearts don't really use much in the way of atrial function to help pump blood through our body. And you can kind of see that, because look how thin the walls of these atria are. They're not very strong at all. Okay, so don't forget about these pacemaker potentials in the nodal cells in the heart. Okay, and if the SA node is prevented from sending action potential to other places of the heart, then other places in the heart will become pacemakers, depending on what the slope of that pacemaker potential is in that particular tissue. And these are what we call ectopic pacemakers. But in the normal heart, there's only one. So what's the normal pacemaker? Or what's the pacemaker in the normal heart called? That's the SA node, right? That's the SA node. All right, now let's look at action potentials from the usual myocardial cell, not nodal cells that have those HCN channels that spontaneously depolarize, okay, but just a regular contractile cell. So here we have a plot of voltage versus time. And so this is what an action potential looks like from a myocardial cell. And how can you describe maybe the difference of this action potential compared to the one that you're familiar with for a nerve fiber already? Huh? Extremely fast. Oh, I mean this depolarization right here is extremely fast. It depolarizes very fast. Okay. The resting membrane potential maybe is a little bit more negative. It's about minus 70 for most cells, but for a myocardial cell, you know, it's maybe closer to minus 90. That's maybe not so important. Okay, but what about the duration of this action potential? It's a lot longer. Okay, so the duration of an action potential for a myocardial cell is a lot longer because another kind of channel is operating. All right, so when a myocardial cell reaches threshold, it depolarizes very, very rapidly, okay, to probably about 15 plus millivolts. All right, but then instead of potassium channels opening up right away and repolarizing and hyperpolarizing, look at this region right here. This is what we call the plateau region of an action potential for a myocardial cell, and this is very long. It lasts for about 150 milliseconds. And this is due to calcium channels that open up. So where is calcium high? Outside the cell or inside the cell? It's high outside. So when calcium channels open up, calcium moves from high concentration outside to low, which is inside. And what does that do to the membrane potential? This calcium goes from outside to inside. Because calcium has a charge on it, it's going to affect the membrane potential. It's going to depolarize that cell, just like sodium is going to depolarize that cell. So it maintains, right, the cell in a depolarized state until the calcium channels start to close, right, and then the potassium channels, as these calcium channels start to close, then the potassium channels that are open win out and these cells start to repolarize. Okay. Well, remember, just like an action potential in a nerve, there was a refractory period. What the heck is a refractory period? When another action potential couldn't be stimulated in that nerve fiber once again. Okay. And what is interesting about muscle cells is during this plateau phase right here, the refractory period then becomes very, very long for myocardial cells. Right, so another action potential can't be stimulated during this time until the myocardial cell repolarizes. Right, and that's really important because if there can't be another action potential, that can't cause this muscle cell to contract again until after the refractory period. So myocardial cells can't contract very rapidly because of the refractory period, and as a result, okay, the myocardial cell can't go into tetanus, a sustained contraction. But what about skeletal muscle? If you're walking down the street, do you ever get a cramp in a muscle, or maybe lying in bed or something? And that's because the action potential in skeletal muscle is so short, or it can be stimulated again and cause a contraction before the contraction has relaxed. But in a myocardial cell, because action potentials are so long, the heart has to relax before it can be stimulated into contracting again, which is a really good thing because you would never want to be walking down the street and then get a cramp, for instance, quote unquote, in your heart, right? So if your heart were to go into tetanus and contract, then of course you would die very rapidly as a result of that because blood couldn't get into the heart and the heart couldn't pump any blood. So the heart cannot go into tetany because of this plateau phase in the action potential of myocardial cells. All right, so you should be able to answer that. Why can't the heart go into tetany like skeletal muscle? Because of the refractory period produced by this plateau region in the action potential of myocardial cells. And what kind of channel produces this plateau region in myocardial cells? It's a channel that skeletal muscles don't have. It's that calcium channel, okay, that stay open and depolarize. Okay. All right, so we covered that already. Action potentials from the SA node spread at a rate of about 1 meter per second through the atrium or through the atria. And then there's a time delay that occurs as action potentials pass through the AV node, that the conduction speed is much slower, right, about 0.05 meters per second. So the AV node acts as a delay of entry of signals into the ventricles, and this is important because this causes the atria to contract first before the ventricles. And then the action potential speed increases through the Purkinje fibers up to about 5 meters per second, spreading depolarization through the whole ventricular myocardium, and then the ventricles contract about 100 or 200 milliseconds after the contraction of the atria. All right, so there's a short time delay due to what? The AV node, due to the AV node. Okay, and there is sarcoplasmic reticulum in the myocardium, just like skeletal muscle, that helps excitation, contraction, coupling, and sliding of the myofilaments and sarcomeres of skeletal muscle. So the heart contracts as a syncytium. That means the chambers contract together because of those gap junctions. Its action potentials last for about 250 milliseconds, and it has a refractory period almost as long as the whole action potential. So the heart can't be stimulated again until that refractory period is over. So here we have two graphs. Here we have the membrane potential, so this is voltage versus time, and then this line right here is actually the tension that's developed by that part of the heart. So this is contraction of the heart. Notice that the electrical signal is different than the tension that's produced by the heart, or the contraction of the heart. Which one comes first, the electrical signal or contraction? So here is time right here. Which signal in comes first in time? Is it contraction or the electrical signal? Okay, it's the action potential that comes first, and that's the trigger for contraction. All right, so here is the absolute refractory period, and even though the muscle cell is in absolute refractory period, it still contracts the first time, all right, and can't contract again until way out over here when the heart is already relaxed. So this, again, just shows that the heart can't go into tetanus. It can't go into a cramp, and, of course, that would be very dangerous. Okay, so here is a plot of your electrocardiogram. So that's voltage versus time. Plotted out of what the membrane potential looks like, voltage versus time. And the electrocardiogram is something that we can measure on the surface of somebody's body, which is an accumulation of what? Millions and millions of these action potentials that are all produced by the millions of cells that you have in the heart. So just by putting on electrodes on your ankles and wrists and maybe on your chest, we can measure the electrical activity of the heart. We call that the electrocardiogram. So why is it sometimes it's spelled EKG instead of ECG? Okay, you'll find, even in the same hospital, you'll see signs, ECG. One hallway is going to be ECG, another hallway is going to be EKG. Is it the same thing? As a matter of fact, it's exactly the same thing. And, well, the first people that first started working, as far as I know, with electrocardiograms were in Europe. And in Europe, they spell cardio with a K instead of a C. Okay? And so it means exactly the same thing. EKG and ECG is really the same thing, but in German, cardio is started with a K instead of a C. All right, and so we just interchange it all the time. Okay, so the P wave is the first wave, and then there's a big complex right here, which we call the QRS, and then the T wave. These represent different events inside the heart. So this one right here, does this look like a pacemaker potential, or does this look like an action potential from a cell that's going to contract? Action potential from a contractile cell. Remember what a pacemaker cell looks like? Pacemaker cell looks like this, okay? It just spontaneously depolarizes. But this is what an action potential from a contractile myocardial cell looks like. And let's superimpose that on top of the electrocardiogram. All right, so this electrical activity, QRS complex, is due to a couple reasons, but primarily it's due to depolarization of the ventricles. And it's a large signal because what can you tell me about the number of cells in the ventricles compared to the atria? What do the ventricles look like compared to the atria? Does the wall thickness look the same? No, the ventricles are 10 or 20 times thicker than the atria. So there's many, many more cells. And when all of those cells depolarize, it just produces a bigger electrical signal. So the QRS complex represents depolarization of the ventricles. All right, and then there's this plateau region where the voltage isn't changing. And then the ventricles, what do we call this right here? That is repolarization, and that produces another big signal on the surface of our body that produces the T wave. So the QRS complex is due to ventricular depolarization. The T wave is due to ventricular repolarization. And what we don't show over here, all right, is what happens before the ventricles depolarize. What kind of electrical events happen in the heart before the ventricles depolarize? Yeah, the atria have to depolarize first because that's where the pacemaker is. So if we were to draw that, we would see that right here, they would depolarize corresponding to the P wave, and then it would repolarize right in this region right here, which corresponds to what? The depolarization of the ventricles. Okay, so let's go over this. The P wave represents atrial depolarization, all those millions of cells in the atria depolarizing. Okay, and that's it. The QRS complex is due to two things. We see here ventricular depolarization, but what happens to the atrial cells after they depolarize? They have to repolarize as well. So the QRS complex is due to two things: ventricular depolarization and atrial repolarization. Or maybe I should say it in the right order. P wave is atrial depolarization. The QRS is atrial repolarization plus now the ventricles depolarize, so those two things. And then the T wave is due to ventricular repolarization. Okay, so in the QRS complex, we can't separate atrial repolarization from ventricular depolarization. They're all just grouped together, and so it's just a composite signal of all those different events. Okay, and we can measure this on the surface of somebody's body. Okay, so who's got a question on that? Should I write that on the board? What the P wave is? I think you covered that in lab too. Are you shaking your head? Yes, write it on the board or no? Yeah. Okay, so P wave, what do we got? We got a couple waves. We got P, QRS, and T. The P wave has only one thing. Atrial, I won't spell it out, depolarization. Okay, why do they call it the P wave? I don't think I ever learned why, but what do you call the first thing, like in Latin? Like primavera, right? That's probably why they named it the P wave, because it's the first wave. Okay, atrial depolarization. QRS complex, after atrial depolarization, the atria have to repolarize. So the QRS is atrial repolarization plus now the ventricles depolarize. So ventricular depolarization, both of those are within the QRS, and then the T wave, I guess I'll do this, the T wave is due to ventricular repolarization. Okay. Yeah, it's not very hard to see, I don't think. Did I put it on the board right? Yeah, okay. All right, so this picture right here just shows the spread of depolarization starting in the SA node, flowing through both atria because it's a functional syncytium. All right, and that causes the P wave. It's delayed within the AV node right here because it conducts very slowly, and so the ECG goes to zero. And then as the signal moves through the AV node into the Down the bundle branches, it conducts very, very rapidly down to the apex of the heart. The signals leave the Purkinje fibers, so the apical regions of the heart depolarize first, which causes contraction in the apical regions first. All right, so now this part of the myocardium depolarizes completely. Both ventricles depolarize. And then finally, they start to repolarize. So are these little waves right here color-coded with what you see in here? Yeah. Oh, that's nice. Okay. Okay, so atria contract first, then the ventricles. And what part of the ventricles contract first? You should probably see that from this slide. Is it going to be the apical region or the basal region? Okay, here's the basal region. Here's the apical region. Which region depolarizes first? Basal region or apical region? Yeah, which one depolarizes? So what's depolarization? Is this color? Is that this right here? All right, well, the apical regions depolarize first, which means the apical regions contract first, not the basal regions right here. And that's really good, because how does blood leave the heart through an artery? Is it through the region down here? If we started to squeeze blood down to the apex, would blood leave the heart? No, because the arteries are up by the base, so the heart has to squeeze down by the apex, forcing blood up to the base and out the arteries. All right, so the conduction of the conduction system of the heart is real important, not only to control the contraction between the atria and the ventricles, but also control how the ventricle contracts, so it forces blood up and out of the heart. Okay. All right, so we talked about that slide already. All right, structure of blood vessels. You know what? This is just a nice review from anatomy. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time with this. Okay, the innermost layer of all blood vessels is the endothelium. It's a simple squamous epithelium, and a capillary only has an endothelium. It doesn't have the other layers, like the tunica media and tunica externa, which contain muscle and connective tissue and elastic tissue. So exchange can only take place in a capillary because it's very thin, because that's the only place that has just a simple squamous epithelium. Arteries and veins have these other layers that prevent diffusion of material from arteries and veins into the tissue spaces. Okay. Large arteries are muscular arteries, and some are elastic. Some of the arteries that contain a lot of elastic tissue would be, for instance, the aorta. So when the heart pumps blood into the aorta, it expands. And then as the heart relaxes, guess what happens to that expansion? It contracts back down, and it helps maintain blood flow through the arterial system even though the heart is relaxing during diastole. All right, so small arteries and arterioles are muscular in nature. They don't have elastic tissue. And they provide most of the resistance to flow through the cardiovascular system because they can dilate and constrict. Resistance increases when they constrict, and resistance decreases when they dilate. Okay, and arterioles are connected to capillary beds, and capillaries are very thin-walled vessels that allow for exchange to take place. Okay, so here is blood. Why is blood going to move from this artery over here through a capillary bed into this vein right here? Why is that going to happen? I see these arrows pointing through right here. Why is that going to happen? What's the force moving blood in that direction? Yeah, pressure. So there's higher pressure in arteries, and there's lower pressure in veins. So blood is going to flow in that direction. All right, so of these vessels right here, we've got arteries, capillaries, and veins. Which one has the lowest pressure? Veins. Good, that's good that you said that. A lot of students say, oh, well, capillaries have the lowest pressure. Well, capillaries are very important because that's the only site for exchange, but that doesn't mean they have the lowest pressure. Because if capillaries had the lowest pressure, which way would blood flow between a vein and a capillary? Yeah, it would flow from the vein back into a capillary, right? And blood would flow from artery into a capillary, all the blood would flow into a capillary, and then what would happen? Well, you would explode, okay, or something. I'm not sure what would happen, all right, but it certainly wouldn't support any kind of living processes, right, because blood wouldn't circulate. Okay, but there is something that controls blood through various capillary beds in your body. We don't have enough blood in our circulation to go to all of our tissues at one time. Your body has to select where that blood is going to go. If you're exercising, blood is going to go to muscle. If you're in a fed state, blood is going to go to your digestive tract. So you can't really exercise and eat at the same time without causing some kind of cardiovascular malady that's going to produce muscle cramps, for instance. Okay, and the way that blood is shunted from one place in your body to another is due to these circular smooth muscles that guard the entrance to a capillary bed, and we call these the pre-capillary sphincters. So a sphincter is just a nice circular smooth muscle. It can constrict or it can dilate, and these things are not innervated. They listen to chemicals that are released from the tissues around these capillary beds. So for instance, if this is an exercising muscle, right, that is using up a lot of ATP and producing ADP, that ADP can come over to this precapillary sphincter and cause it to dilate, right, and that's going to increase blood supply to that muscle, which is what the muscle needs to contract. All right, when a muscle is contracting, maybe it doesn't have enough oxygen to make ATP. Under that circumstance, what is the muscle going to be producing? It's using ATP up. Does it have enough oxygen to replace it? What happens to respiration? What form of respiration is taking over and what's produced? Anaerobic respiration. What's produced with anaerobic respiration? Lactic acid or lactate. All right, so that lactic acid is going to diffuse out of the muscle cells. That's also going to cause vasodilation of the precapillary sphincter. All right, so control of the precapillary sphincter is not due to nervous innervation, but just due to the local activity of the cells in this capillary bed. So we say that these precapillary sphincters are under local control. They're not under reflex control, but local control that respond to the demands of the individual tissues right here because they produce different kinds of chemicals. All right, and this slide I'm not going to go over, but you got to read it over by next time, and we're going to start here next time because this is just a review from anatomy. Okay. Oh, we got two more slides. I tell you what, let's finish this up. Let's finish this up before we go. Yeah, all right. Okay. Okay, so veins. It contains the majority of blood. It has the largest volume of blood vessels in your body. They're very compliant. That means that they can vasodilate very rapidly. There's not a lot of elastic tissue in them. There's muscle, and when those muscles relax, they dilate and blood can pool in veins. And veins contain the lowest pressure, about 2 millimeters of mercury. What's the pressure? What's the systolic pressure in the aorta? It's 120. See, there's a big difference in pressure, 120 versus 2. So blood for sure is going to flow from 120 millimeters of mercury to 2 because that's the lowest pressure. All right, but there's still not a lot of pressure difference then from a vein compared to the right atrium of the heart. There's only about 2 millimeters of mercury pressure difference. So how does blood actually get all the way back to the heart if there's not a big pressure difference? Okay, there are two important reasons. Okay, so veins travel between muscles in a lot of parts of your body, and when these muscles contract, what happens to the state of these muscles, the size of these muscles? They shorten, but what else do they do? Watch. What else do they do when they contract? They bulge, okay? All right, and when they bulge, they compress this vein, all right? So they pressurize the vein, and so since the blood in this vein is pressurized, it's going to want to squirt one way or another. But what is one structural feature of a vein that prevents retrograde flow? Veins have valves. Arteries don't need valves, but veins have valves. So when this blood becomes pressurized, It tries to go back to the tissue, but it can't because of this valve. It squirts back to the heart. So the skeletal muscles, all the skeletal muscles in your body act like a pump, help pushing blood back up to the heart, okay, due to these little transient changes in pressure when a muscle contracts. Okay, the second thing that works as well is what we call the respiratory pump. When we expand our chest, right, what happens when we expand our chest, what fluid flows into our chest? As long as your mouth and nose are clear, what happens? We expand the volume of our chest, the pressure decreases in our thoracic cavity when it expands. All right, so it's low pressure. What's the pressure in the atmosphere? It's pretty much constant, so it's high. So air will flow, because air is just a fluid, it will flow from high pressure to low pressure in our lungs, and our lungs will inflate as a result of that when we expand our chest by depressing the diaphragm, for instance. It expands the volume of our chest. But that's not the only other fluid that's inside our thoracic cavity. It's not just air. What else is inside our thoracic cavity? What's another fluid? Well, you have blood. Okay, you have blood in blood vessels, namely veins. And when you expand your chest, the pressure in those veins actually becomes lower. And so when you breathe in, not only is air the fluid air entering your thoracic cavity, but blood from other parts of your body actually gets sucked into your thoracic cavity. And what's in your thoracic cavity? That's your heart right there, right? So that helps return a blood flow to the heart. So those two things, contraction of skeletal muscle and also changes in thoracic cavity volume during breathing, helps suck blood back to the heart. And we call that the respiratory pump. And don't forget these valves that prevent retrograde flow. Okay, so that's it. So don't forget about that anatomy of the stomach. How big can the stomach get? What allows the stomach to distend? Rugae. You know, and there's enough rugae in the stomach, so the stomach is right about here. And if you eat and eat and eat, the stomach can actually distend all the way down to the bladder without rupturing. So don't do that tomorrow.